The Articulate Coven is the original, unofficial podcast and fan community for Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire and Anne Rice's Immortal Universe from AMC and AMC+.
Welcome to The Articulate Coven. We're your hosts. I'm Joel.
I'm Ashley.
And we are The Articulate Coven. The Articulate Coven is the unofficial fan podcast and fan community for Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire, The Vampire Chronicles at Large, Mayfair Witches, and both of those series and everything else that AMC and AMC Plus are bringing us in the Immortal Universe. We are
whether
in the
we like it or not.
That's right. That's right. Sometimes they bring us stuff we don't like.
It's fine.
We're in the middle of our rewatch of season one for Interview with the Vampire. We're watching episode six tonight, Like Angels Put in Hell by God. And Ashley, this episode really stood out to me in just how much ground it covered. You know, the whole season, we've talked about time dilation a little bit and the fact that because of the ways that they've altered Louis and Lestat's story, there are interesting periods of time when you really look at it. They spend several years apart. They're together longer than they are in the books, and yet Claudia is part of their relationship earlier than it is in the books, and there's all sorts of slides here. But this one, I mean, there's a lot in this episode. We think about the last episode is so impactful. Obviously, the finale is a big moment, but this one gets a lot of stuff done.
They cover so much mileage time-wise. I mean, it is... I paid more attention to that this time. I think that I was just so... The first watch, I was just so caught up in what was happening and recovering from the shock and horror of the previous episode. Oh. And that it was, you know, it, like this episode, I don't think I ever really settled into watching as much as I did this viewing. And some of it, I think that we saw some of it, too much happened off screen. I think I could have used a little bit more to show me how Claudia gets to this point. You know what I mean?
I mean,
obviously, we see a few moments where Lestat is horrifically cruel to her. But I just feel like I wish I'd seen more of what got us here.
I agree. And I'm not certain exactly what I would have done if they gave me another episode. Like, what would you do with it?
Yeah,
as far
I don't
as
know.
The full plot? What's the A plot? What's the B plot? How does everything fall out?
It would just be more of
eight episodes.
More of them, I guess, which, you know, is what we want.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I mean,
that's true.
Just
more
is
fine.
Of that relationship. I don't think that there's really not any like points from the book that they left out or missed or didn't include that they could have in this like time period. This is a real amorphous time period in the book too. I just think that I wish I'd just seen more of their life.
I wish that there was a little bit more honest tenderness between Louis and Lestat in this episode. I think that's what I really miss. It's hard in the reading of it to see exactly why Louis goes back. We
yeah.
understand why Claudia remains standoffish, and the nature of her and Lestat's relationship is very clear in this episode. We understand how Lestat needs Louis so much and why he continues to pursue Louis even through all of their hardships and overcoming the fight from last episode. But why does Louis go back? In this watching, that was the big question for me, and it just never really rings true. Yes, I understand that he's attracted to Lestat and he probably even loves him. He claims in the modern day, Daniel asks him this very question, and Louis falls back several times on the vampire bond, which we know he's kind of blowing smoke up the ass there because
right.
that's not the way that works exactly. It's not
yeah.
it's not a magical connection.
It kind of messes up your magical connection you had before you
right,
turned.
It,
you know,
it
you lose
disconnects
that
you in the brain. Literally.
Yeah.
I don't know. I felt like, you know, my feeling last week that Louis' indecision and lack of willpower and lack of self-determination is sort of like fundamental to the falling apart of this relationship and their quote-unquote happy home. I think the way that they portray Louis in this episode reinforces that read to me. And I don't think that's exactly what the creators were going for, but I'm just searching for Louis' motivation in his return to Lestat here. It seems like one of desperation and one of like lack of. It's like he's not aware of his options. Like
it's
he
almost
doesn't
like
see.
He wants. I feel like it's almost like he wants to prove Claudia wrong, but he knows he can't.
Mm. I mean, to me, it's like he does not see Europe as viable for him. When he tells Claudia goodbye towards the end, we're skipping ahead here quite a bit, but when he tells Claudia that she doesn't need him towards the end of the episode, I think he's being honest with her from his perspective anyway there.
Yeah.
But it seems so defeatist for him to not pursue those things anymore. And particularly since it was Louis's fascination as much as Claudia's with the origin of his species and what is the purpose of vampirism in the universe, et cetera, et cetera. Like, is there some bigger meaning?
Are we damned creatures? Yeah,
none of that's really there right now.
Nothing. He's so flat and defeated, and it is this episode's so interesting, and it's not like I didn't like it, and I don't mean for it to come across that way at all. I just the vibe of it is so different than anything else that we've seen this season. And I do think we see some real moments that are like the real truth coming through. I think when Lestat is telling them about Magnus and how he was created and what happened, I think that was really real. That was a real moment. Louis is remembering that moment correctly. You know, I don't know whose memory of the train we're seeing, you know, when Lestat comes to the train. So it's so confusing, like trying to place this episode in the narrative voice, figuring out whose version of what we're watching. It's a little wacky, and it is the vibe that you get in a dysfunctional household that you feel like you walking on eggshells. You don't want to anger anybody. There's always some asshole that's trying to antagonize everyone. There's always the person who's the aggressor. There's always the smart ass that's going to get everybody in trouble, and like the long suffering spouse that's just trying to keep everything together. But even Louis doesn't even seem to have the energy for that, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting mix. I had not considered it when I was rewatching tonight, but just as you mentioned in the beginning, it feels like they shoved too much into this. I could have used a little more. We have to remember, and it's worth calling out here, the original plan was to do the entire first book's adaptation in one season, 8 episodes. That was the plan. Then AMC comes late in the game and says to the creative team, "Hi, could we make it 2 seasons, 7 this year to do half the book? Could we do that?" And the main reason was because of the pandemic, it was difficult to plan getting to Paris, basically. They couldn't do the right European part of the book economically with the COVID restrictions. And so it got shuffled around because of that. And I think this is an example of how if this had been an 8-episode season, as season 2 is going to be, I think we could have filled this out a little bit better and given this more of a rounding. Even with that, though, you mentioned earlier, like, yeah, we it's not that we don't like this episode. We quite do like this episode. Both of us do. By the way, yeah. I forgot our template. Let me get that. Director for this episode, Levin Aiken. The writers for this one, Colleen Albert, Anne Rice, and Rollin Jones. Those are our credits for this one. Like Angels Put in Hell by God, the title of this episode. Right up here off the top. Let's jump into our discussion, chronologically a little bit.
Yes.
I love this discussion at the opening of the episode. He could fly like Superman, and Louis goes, "Not like Superman. Superman's a fictional character."
Right.
I love it when fictional characters poo-poo other fictional characters.
It's so
I just
meta.
Adore it.
Yes. I like it when other like fictitious worlds are mentioned in your fictitious world. I enjoy that. It's just a little bit of pop culture fun for me.
Daniel's got a great line there too in response. Yeah, but in the air with a fuck you to Newtonian physics flying.
That is a great line. He's fantastic in this episode, as always.
He is really, really good. And right in that beginning of the conversation, we see that he's getting his medicine applied by Dr. Farid, Louis asks him again, "Are you still dreaming of the night that we met?" Okay. We've talked about the trailer for season 2 last week and the fact that it makes Armand a little bit more sympathetic seeming in the read of that. Like, he's not the one pulling the strings necessarily. This is one of those moments where I very much go back and go, What is the purpose of bringing Daniel here? Are they trying to open up his memory holes? If they are, they're the ones that created them. Why are they unlocking them? Why is that important now? Why is that the plan? Why are they doing it? Why not just reveal it to him? Why slow roll it like this?
Yeah, why do they want this story told in this way? Like, it is like, because it's very different from the setup of the book. The book setup is more simple. It's what we see in the past. It's, hey, I met a vampire in a bar, and he told me he was going to tell me his story. So I was like, why not? Whereas this is like, this meeting, this is much more manipulated, and they've clearly spent some time planning on how they were going to go about this, you know, this interview with Daniel. And so it's so fucking creepy to me at times. I'm just like, what are you guys doing to this man?
Yeah. I'm hoping by the time we get to the end of season two that we'll feel on more solid ground about all of this and who is in what position and why they all ended up here and how this is happening, why it's happening. But right here, as I'm watching this episode, even having seen the rest of the season, I'm shaky myself. I'm not sure where we are and who's in charge and what we're doing. But I think that's exactly what the creators want you to be feeling at this moment, you know?
Oh, yeah. And part of the thing with the rewatch is that, you know, we're sitting here with full knowledge of who Rashid is, you know, and we're with full knowledge of what happens in the next several books. And so it's natural to be like, what the fuck? And try to really sort of suss it all out and figure out what's actually, you know, what version of the story are we getting? Whose version are we getting? What's going on? Who's in charge? What's the sound in the building?
Okay, speaking of the books, though, I want to call this out and acknowledge, I love that they call it the cloud gift. They refer to Lestat's flying as the cloud gift.
He corrects him, too. He's like, nope, this is what it is.
And guys, that's some weird Anne Rice shit. No other vampire universe calls flying the cloud gift. That's not the way that people refer to it. Her vampires have specifically talked about, and Louis calls it out here, it's more like floating.
Yeah.
It feels very unnatural. If even for the vampires who are capable of it, it feels very unnatural. And many of them don't like to do
it. Don't
like
to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it disconnects them from humanity even further and makes them feel, you know, outside of creation. And the cloud gift, as its title, really encapsulates that in a way. The other thing is, I love that she also calls the ability to create fire. She calls that the fire gift. I think that that very concept, the idea that they are referring to them as gifts, not a spoiler for the show, but in the books, you understand eventually where all of this comes from and the way that the vampires are connected together. And I think calling it gifts, that fits in the overall, like, I don't know, pantheon
universe.
Of her universe. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. And it's, again, those subtle nods that, to a non-reader would not mean anything. They'd be like, oh, it's floating, and they call it a cloud gift. But to a reader, you're like, oh, thank you for getting that little thing right that actually means something to me.
I know we talked about it a lot at length in our original watch, but I like the cameo for Dr. Farid here. He's a character that we meet later in the novels, and I'm not going to spoil any of that for you, but really, really neat little hint at the broader world that we're going to get to eventually. And
also, he's hilarious.
Yeah, I'm not here.
I'm not here. No one saw me. Yeah, it's funny. He's hilarious in these moments, in these scenes.
Louis asks a question to Daniel when they're first talking about the reconciliation. Are we the sum of our worst moments? And I think that is something that, like, personally, I don't ask that enough about people that I don't trust and don't like. People that have wronged me, I don't give them that benefit of a doubt and think, oh, is that their worst moment, you know, that I'm holding against them?
You know, fool me once and then fool me twice. You don't get fooled again, Joel. Yeah, because you also have to keep that piece in mind, too. I don't know. Yeah, it's like once a cheater, always a cheater. Once an abuser, always an abuser, you know, and some of that is really true shit. And then it is. What are we looking at the worst moments of this relationship? we haven't gotten to see really nice, we don't see any nice moments in this episode in anyone's relationships, not even with Louis and Claudia. Like right off the bat, you know, they're talking about Lestat's like, oh, are we eating four-legged or two-legged these days, you know? And he and Claudia both agree that he makes them feel less than because of the way he looks down on them choosing to feed on humans.
I mean, okay.
It's
wondered,
huge disconnects between everybody.
In the watch tonight, the first thing that occurred to me, and I would love to hear from some of our audience about this if you happen to be in this situation. Do we have somebody that listens to this show who is a vegan but is married to a meat eater?
Ooh, that's an interesting question.
That's the way that I heard it tonight, Ashley. I really did. And I was like, God, what would I do? I'm a very picky eater. I have like four things, period, that I enjoy, honestly. And none of them are very good for me, but definitely almost none of them are vegetable-based either. And I think I literally was watching that and thinking to myself, what if Kelly decided she was vegan? You know, what if my partner... And not just vegan from a health standpoint, but I specifically say vegan instead of vegetarian because generally vegans have at least some level of ethical reasoning behind their decision.
Absolutely.
And I mean, listen, anytime I hear a study about the intelligence of pigs, I am a little sad about how much I like bacon.
Very sad about how delicious bacon is. Because I know pigs are smart and they're
like
cute
maybe
and clever.
Sentient, you know, like,
it
yeah.
It sucks,
like,
but bacon is delicious, damn it. And I'm with Lestat. Let's go eat some. No, we're not going to go eat some people. But I get where he's coming from.
Well, I mean, realistically, this the very sad thing for us and our ethical dilemmas here, Ashley, is that we can't point and say, well, I'm only eating the bad pigs.
Right, exactly. Because every pig is good.
Okay.
We don't eat dogs, okay?
Well, yes. Well, and we don't eat dolphin as a general rule, right?
That's right. Like, we have ethics.
We have ethics, Joel, lines, but I will say most of the lines are based on which animals are really cute.
Yeah. But you know what? We can eat our dino-shaped chicken nuggets if we want. No one can take those from us.
Vegan-based dinosaur-shaped chicken nuggets probably if we hunt. Lestat's origin story, you referenced it earlier, the story where he talks about Magnus in this episode. I do absolutely agree with you. I think this is one of those moments of truth in everyone's story that is unfolding for us. And I think it's a perfect mirror to the first episode when he tells the story about being dragged away from the convent by his father.
Yes.
And his brothers. You know, my father was a crude man and vulgar. My father was a vulgar man.
Vulgar man, yeah.
And those two moments, and it's interesting, I think, that the two moments that seem to be really true representations of who Lestat are in this season, they're both, those moments are both about pain.
And very vulnerable.
Yeah.
Very vulnerable. You know, it's almost like maybe that's a memory that if Armand is the one that's messing with Louis's mind and memories, if that's the case, it's like it's such a true moment that it can't be futzed with.
Well, okay. Interesting that you mention that because those are also both moments that Armand himself identifies with from his own story, right? The nature of his cruel makers and the leaders that he had over him in his early time as a vampire. Like his maker obviously was, it's a good relationship between Marius
right,
and Armand.
Right, absolutely.
But after that, he's stolen away and he's, you know, controlled by the coven under Les Innocents and all these terrible, and then he's in the theater, which he didn't really like, and on and on and on. And so like, there's a long time period for Armand where he is not in control of his life and he's governed by forces that he detests in a lot
of ways. Yes. I was thinking that as well. Like he's, for as strong and powerful as Armand is, he is so frequently swayed by or controlled by whatever more powerful person is near him. And it's so interesting because Louis is, generally speaking, physically as a vampire and as well as just as the Eeyore that he is, a weaker personality, a weaker, you know, and so this is like the time that he gets to be the one in charge. Like you never get that with Lestat.
No, and it is, it's such an interesting dynamic between the three of them. You know, Armand is the most powerful for most of their lives of Lestat, Armand, and Louis. And yet, Armand is very much controlled and dictated to by Lestat in all their interactions.
Absolutely.
Louis is the weakest of the three, and yet, really, and he doesn't admit it and doesn't understand it, but he dominates and controls the relationship between Louis and Lestat, especially as portrayed in the TV series. It felt that way in the books, honestly. It's, I mean, we've talked about this before. Anytime you have a relationship where it feels pretty clearly that one of the parties needs the other more than the other, right?
Absolutely.
Lestat needs Louis in a way that Louis does not need Lestat. And Louis won't admit that to himself and understand the power that he has in this relationship, but it's absolutely there for anybody that wants to view it. It's an incredibly interesting dynamic, and I do think if you're viewing season one as a story told by Louis, or excuse me, told through Louis by Armand, really, which is one way to read what's happening here. If you're looking at it that way, then it makes sense that those two moments would be moments that would shine through true for Lestat, as they are the moments in Lestat's life, or some of the moments in Lestat's life, that Armand connects with so completely as well. It's very interesting dynamic there. Rollin Jones is a good writer, guys. I don't know what to tell you.
I mean, I'm sorry for it. No, we're happy. I do think Claudia is unlikable in this episode. And I wonder what lens that's being shown through. Like, she is just cold and hard, and I know she has to be that way in some ways, but the only time I feel like we get even a glimpse of her, truly her, is on that train.
You know, the Oedipal idea of, you know, kill the father kind of thing is something that I think, I mean, Freud talks about it all the time too, right? Like, you, I think that is real for adolescents as they approach, like, that time to leave the house. I think there is a natural antagonistic relationship that builds. My mom jokes all the time about the fact that I left her house on the first day of my senior year, the same little boy that she'd loved and had been adorable this whole time, and I came home from school that day like a raging asshole who basically picked a fight with her continually for that next year. I mean, just she I know for a fact she had several conversations with her sister like, I don't know if he's going to live until it's time for him to leave the house.
Because I may kill him.
Yeah, genuinely. So, like, I graduated high school. I started college right away. Like, I did an early session that summer. And when the summer session was over, there was, like, 3 weeks where I was back at home for a little while. And I stayed home for, like, 2 days and then went to my aunt's house in South Louisiana for, like, 2 weeks, I think. But I think that's real, and I think that's sort of what Claudia is doing in this episode. She is steeling herself for what she knows is coming. I am going to break away from this.
That's a really good point.
And I'm
going
to try to take Louis with me, but if I can't, then fine. I am going to be free.
I'm going to kill this motherfucker.
Well, and I think early on, it's not. I think she's hoping that she won't. I mean, she tries to leave, right? She just tries to leave and forget him.
No, he
and
won't.
Lestat
the
won't
fact
let
that
her.
He won't let her leave alone is horrifying. Like, that's not a thing that really was possible for Claudia in the book. She couldn't have gone on her own. She looks like she was five, you know what
I mean?
She's
like 5 or 6 years
old. A literal child. Like, she could not have gone on her own, but this Claudia could have just gone on her own. He could have let her leave in peace. Well, and he does not allow it.
Okay, and you asked earlier, like, whose voice are we getting in this, particularly the scene where we flash back to the train and we see her drag, or we see Lestat drag her back, basically.
Also, the thing with the head is so funny. I cannot help
that
it.
Whole,
I know it's
the
so
whole
grim.
Scene's hilarious. It really
that
is.
The scene is so funny to me, and it's very Lestat, which is why it's also really upsetting, because you're like, oh, this is very Lestat-y.
It's, you know, one of those, like, moments where you are confronted with the fact that one of your favorite characters is an absolute sociopath.
a complete lunatic. Yeah, 100%.
So, but I will say, though, the way that it plays in this episode, especially in this, for this rewatch, it played to me as if, here's what Louis knows. Louis knows that she went to leave and then didn't.
Yep.
And that was played out in a confrontational moment with Lestat revealing it as Louis comes home. Oh, our sister came back.
Oh, thank goodness. Thank goodness she didn't go to Europe. Thank goodness she changed her mind.
I think the way that they played it is literally, this is Louis's imagination of how that scene played out. I don't think Claudia ever told him what happened. I don't think Lestat ever told him what happened. I think he knows she made it to the train, or he's pretty confident she made it to the train, and he is convinced that Lestat drug her back. So what did that look like? And this is what it would look like. Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty good scene he made. Because it does feel like our guy.
I agree.
I need my guys to have a little fun again. And I just worry we're not going to get very much fun in season two.
And we're almost definitely not going to get any fun romantic stuff with Lestat and Nicholas either. I know we've talked previously. It does look like Nicholas is going to have at least a scene or two in season two in the flashbacks that we see. But I don't think we're going to get very much, if at all, of the pre-Paris relationship between Nicholas and
Lestat. Yeah, oh, I bet you're right. Yeah, I don't think we'll get much of that.
And even when they first get to Paris, they have really good times when they first get to Paris before Armand and the Coven, you know, or confront them before Magnus. And I don't think we're going to see that either. I think those scenes are not going to come until season three. So realistically, the show that was very much pitched in season one as a romance, you know, a dark romance, of course, but a romance in some ways, there's not going to be a whole lot of romance for a while, it seems to me. It's a little sad, but on the flip side, though, and this is true for the books too, right? The relationship between Louis and Lestat takes a long time to come back to a stable resolve. And when it is finally presented to us as the two of them back together and happy, incredibly satisfying. And it's a moment that was anticipated and built to for a long time. Books and books and books and books. So I got patience, and I love these two actors. And I'm
You know,
I do hope, though, that we find moments for levity and pleasure.
Yes,
and
I do too.
Camaraderie, at least.
Yes. Also, some fun days at the theater.
I will say, we're going to get our romance with Armand, right? Like, Louis and Armand are going to have a romance next season, and so we will see some of that, at least.
I guess. I'm being such a brat right now.
Let's talk about a brat.
Next season's going to be a real bummer.
Let's talk about a brat. Claudia says to Lestat, after he returns and after they finally accept him back, he says, we should repair that mantle. And she says, we leave the damage so we never forget the damage. And, like, I get it. What he did in last episode, as it's presented, horrible, unforgivable, et cetera, et cetera. Also, these are immortal beings who drink blood for a living. Like,
exactly.
Let's put it all into context.
For a literal living.
But, what a sour position to be in.
I don't want to sit in a fucked up house for the next 50 years. I'd go shag a hot girl in Algiers myself.
Well, you can't build a relationship. You can't rebuild a relationship like that either, right? Like, let's take it down a notch so that it's not violent, you know, near murder of the other partner. Let's make it about an infidelity, for instance, right? Let's just make it about Antoinette for a second. You can't agree that you want to continue the relationship after a betrayal like that, but then also say, we're going to put the betrayal right here in the center of the living room.
Right.
We're going to build a statue to your betrayal.
Actually,
so that we don't forget.
We're going to let her move in to the upstairs apartment.
Right?
And pretend like that's not weird. You know, it's like that. Totally. You're 100% right. It's just, oh.
It was such an unhealthy moment. And it's clear
that they're all choosing to just be fucking miserable.
Yes.
In this episode, which
Claudia is letting it calcify and she's not allowing the healing at all. Now,
well,
I will
maybe
say,
that's,
Louis's not active in the healing, right? I don't
feel
like Louis is patching this up, really.
No. Like you said, I don't understand the impetus to get back together. I really don't get that, aside from jealousy. And realizing a need that maybe he didn't realize he had, or that he wanted to ignore until it came down to this point of, I swim faster than I can drive.
That's a good line. That's a very good
line. Yeah,
that
was a good line.
I want to talk about one of the most brilliant pieces of adaptation in this show versus translation. I made a video the other day about the Dune movies. I rewatched. Everybody remembers that there was a Dune movie in the 70s from David Lynch, or the early 80s, I should say.
Kyle MacLachlan.
Right, exactly. But what a lot of people don't know or have forgotten, there were two actual Dune miniseries made by Sci-Fi in the early 2000s. They did Dune, then they did Children of Dune, which is actually like the book Dune Messiah and Children of Dune put together. But anyway, that Dune miniseries, it's like 4.5 hours long. I watched it the other day on YouTube. It's up there. It's not available anywhere else. But I watched it again after years, because I'm like way into the Duneverse right now.
Yes, anyway, you are.
That miniseries is a great translation of the book. In a lot of ways, it's a much better translation of the book than the Denis Villeneuve films were, and maybe even than the David Lynch films were, or film was. But, it's not as good a movie, right? It's not right. as good a story, honestly. It is a translation, not an adaptation. Sometimes you can leave things and alter things, events, characters, specifics, while maintaining the themes and the overall like trajectory of a story in a way that is more true to the original, even right. though you've changed things. I think this series in general does a great job of that. And here's the example
too.
That I want to call out. Antoinette. In the book, this is Antoine, obviously. Lestat makes Antoine, and we don't discover Antoine until after the attempt on Lestat's life. This series, playing this out as a long-term affair for Lestat yes. with a woman, when our main relationship is between two same-sex attracted men, heck yes, it's such a brilliant play. It is like, and we talked about this definitely in our first watch, there are so many moments in this series where Louis is reminded of what he can't be. He can't be human anymore, he can't be white, he can't be straight, you know, et cetera,
he can't be a woman.
Right, exactly. He can't
know,
be a
that's
woman.
Not.
Yeah, exactly. Lestat wants something and maybe needs something that Louis cannot give him.
Provide,
and the fact that they play that out in this relationship is really, really good. And it heightens
well, he continues,
the whole
he
thing.
Lies. He lies about Antoinette. He continually
yes.
lies about Antoinette. He could just be upfront about Antoinette, but he lies about her. And I don't know what, I don't know if that is real or not.
Right?
Because I don't know anything anymore. I don't know if that's real or if that's Louis's perception.
Maybe he stood up on the bench and said, "I'll see you all at dawn. I'm going to see Antoinette."
Right.
Probably not.
But who knows? I don't.
Great addition, though. I really like that. And the actress is wonderful, by the way.
She's
an
fantastic.
Excellent job in playing, you know, heartbroken, but also, unlike Louis, you understand her motivation to chase Lestat, even through all his betrayals to her.
Yeah. I mean, she could live forever. She could go anywhere she wants with his money. She could be famous. She's dead now, so she can totally recreate herself. I mean, that is not a bad day for a young and upcoming singer in Louisiana.
Well, and the other thing that I love about this relationship is that Antoinette does understand what Lestat needs from her. She does understand her power in the relationship. It's less than Louis's, but she acknowledges it and uses it. Louis is honestly in control of that dynamic between him and Lestat and doesn't understand that and doesn't use it really, except to throw Antoinette out of her own house.
Oh, man. What a
right
move.
After that, by
what
the way.
What a move, man.
Oh, I know.
The audacity. I love it. I mean, that's hot. That's all very hot.
It is pretty sexy. That's true. Louis, right after that, though, has a great line. Claudia's asking him why Lestat is doing these things. And he says, because he's all kinds of fucked up. Because he would have killed her in a second if he thought I'd take him as he is. And I probably will. That's the one moment for me in this episode where Louis really lays out where he's at. He, I think, in that moment at least, understands that Lestat is wrong for him and he shouldn't continue this.
And
yet he also knows that he will.
Yep.
It's
we've all been
because,
there.
Yeah. Well, that's because Louis's all kinds of fucked up. Like,
yeah,
that's the thing.
I mean,
he's calling this on Lestat, but it's true about him too.
We don't get in these relationships when we're mentally well. We get in these relationships when we are trying to escape something, looking for a new start, need someone to believe in us.
Y'all know how when you go to rehab or you get in AA, they tell you not to get in a relationship for a while? Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Keep a plan
advice.
Alive. Yeah. Jesus.
All right. We get a scene right in the middle of the episode here where, well, it's a little towards the end, but Louis addresses Daniel and says specifically, I'd give it to you now.
Yes.
A steady hand. Time to watch your daughters marry. And of course, Daniel turns around on him. And divorce and die. You know, like that's yeah. the downside of immortality. And I do think it's the kind of realization and response that only an older Daniel could give.
Yes.
You can only have, I think, the wherewithal to turn down the concept of immortality when you are facing mortality itself.
Well, Louis just told him that's what happens.
Yeah.
He just tells him, you know, because he talks about what happens with his family and how he had to watch his mother die, which, you know, is a normal thing. Well, most of us will experience that, you know, at some point in our lives we'll lose parents, but you think about losing a brother and then your sister and then everyone you know has gotten older and is gone and you are still there.
How cruel of Louis to say it so flippantly, though. And not just cruel to Daniel, cruel to Armand. It seems like Armand is
yeah.
hurt. And not, I don't think he's hurt by Daniel's rent boy comment. That's rude.
Oh, no.
But I don't think that's why he leaves the room.
I think he expects that from Daniel. I mean, yeah. you expect, he, especially considering how combative and like, not like, super combative, but they're very snippy with each other. They're very like I'm a little smart ass. D-d-d-d-d. Look how smart I am. D-d-d-d-d-d. You know, that's kind of how they bounce off each other.
Well, and it's interesting if you really think about it for a moment in like, what does Daniel, like who does Daniel think Rashid is at this moment? What position of power does Rashid hold in Daniel's understanding of the dynamic here? None. Right? For Daniel's,
right.
What Daniel knows at this moment, Rashid is like hired
a servant.
Help.
Yeah.
He's a minimum wage worker. You know,
yeah.
he's a servant. And yet to still treat him that callously, I don't know, man. It's like it draws a hard line on Daniel. There's nobody that's the good guy here, I guess is what I'm saying. Daniel
well,
is not
yeah.
pure in his motivations or
no.
his attitudes toward these two either.
No, but they know by reaching out to him that they're not putting him in a position to be a good guy.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true, too.
Ugh.
I don't know.
This episode's
really
so interesting because it's like, it's nothing that I'm just like crazy, like passionate about. Like our last chat, we were both just so fired up. And then this one, I'm like, I'm so quizzical and I want
to
really, really figure it out. Like puzzle it out.
Well, I would love to see this scene revisited in season two when Armand is doing more revealing. Like,
yeah.
What? Why did he react this way? Had he and Louis, surely they've discussed giving Daniel the blood if they're bringing him here, right? Right? Like,
right. I mean, that has
to
be
yeah.
at least something you're going to talk about. Like, eventually, if this happens, we're probably going to run into this awkward moment where we have to deal with the fact that,
yeah.
You know, maybe, like, you would have that talk beforehand.
All right, right at the end, great chess scene. And there's like three in this episode, by the way. They're all pretty good, but this
they
final
are.
One is fantastic. Claudia, by the way, is like, we joke about playing three-dimensional chess, but here she's doing it. She's
yeah.
having a debate with Louis telepathically while she is trouncing Lestat
Whooping
without
ass.
His knowledge on the chessboard. And it's fascinating
and
to watch her do it.
And she's talking shit to Lestat while she's
That's
playing.
What I'm saying. Yeah,
like she's
talking
playing,
shit out loud.
Talking shit out loud and talking shit to Louis. It is excellent. It is an excellent display of her growth as a woman and her badassery as a vampire.
Well, and it makes it make sense when in the next episode, the two of them together overcome him. right? Like you, if you looked at last episode, what he does to Louis, and you think, well, how are they ever going to get away from him? You know, what luck must befall them to allow them to overcome Lestat?
No. And I'll say too that that's something that happened in the 94 film as well. Like you see Claudia's the one that has the plan.
Yes.
Claudia's like, we're going to give him the poison blood and then we're going to slit his throat and call it a day and then drag his ass out into the swamp. Like little girl had a plan.
Yeah. And the will to do it.
Yes,
which is
absolutely
what Louis lacks so completely, because she says here at the end, and it's a great line.
I'm going to kill him.
I'm going to tell you the secret, Louis. The secret is you want to kill him too.
Yes.
And you're going to enjoy it when we do it. Do you think that's true? At this moment, does Louis also want to kill Lestat?
I think he wants a way.
And that's the only...
And that's the only way to get away right now. That's the only thing he can see that they can get away. And I also think he wants to... Now, I don't think it's clear in the series as much, but I know part of the motivation in the book was to protect Claudia, to keep Claudia happy, to keep Claudia safe.
Yeah, and again, if we go back to that moment in the train and what Louis does or doesn't know about exactly what happened.
Right, she's terrified, and she's...
That may have been that moment where he goes, I can't keep her safe from him.
Yeah.
You know?
And he's not ever going to let her go. He's not going to let her go because he thinks, I can't be happy without her.
Which, I mean, is true, I think, too. I think the relationship would have gone very badly south for Lestat and Louis if Claudia had gone. And I think eventually Louis probably would have followed her to Europe.
I think that would happen. I think that there would be some calm and then a storm.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think Louis would want to be okay with it and would want to mean what he said.
So
he would want to mean what he said to her, that she's strong enough, she can do it, go get him. You know, like he would want to really mean that because he wouldn't want to have lied to her.
On that same track, what about, let's go back to the earlier part of the episode when Lestat's bringing gifts. He meets them in the street in the new car. He throws the Rolls Royce keys at Claudia and Louis. And then he tells Louis, if you tell me to go, I will. I'll leave you alone. You know, what? Did he mean it? Would he have? We don't know because Louis doesn't ask, right?
No,
Louis doesn't tell him
to
go.
He wouldn't have. Come on.
I mean,
you
probably
know this
not.
Man. Joel, you know this man.
Let's be honest. He lived in Algiers Point for years just to stay close to Louis. So he probably.
Exactly. Exactly.
I joke. Algiers Point's a lovely place. Everyone who lives here is wonderful people. But yeah, I don't know. I kind of think that he might have, actually. I mean, like, it's, again, we have to remember that Lestat has a century plus on the other two. And I do think that he's got an understanding of, like, time frames for vampiric relationships. And I do think I could have left you alone for a lifetime if that's what you would have asked me to do, right? And I'd see you in another one. We're not.
Yeah.
You're
I mean,
not going
that is
anywhere,
true.
And I'm not
like,
either.
There's plenty of time that Lestat is, you know, going forward in books. Lestat is not with Louis all the time. And can be happy and have a good time and get into all kinds of shenanigans with David Talbot and whatever, you know, like he can have himself a good time without Louis. That's very true. I just don't think the way that they've set things up with these particular versions of these characters, I just can't see him being able to leave him behind.
So interesting. And then of course we get to our finale. Okay. I want to talk about two things here. Louis is monologuing and he realizes that Daniel has fallen asleep. He just speaks into the air, Rashid, are you awake? Which first of all, I mean, how creepy that Rashid's monitoring everything.
I mean, he knows. Well, and how, like, if he really thinks Daniel's asleep, why doesn't he call
him
Rashid?
I know.
You got to keep the front up, I guess.
Well, my thing would be, why not use the name there, right? Why not just say, are you still awake? And because then the viewer would have thought it was he was speaking to Daniel, and then Armand's voice comes over the speaker. Like, that could have been its own cool moment, right? Like, oh, how did he know he was talking to him?
Exactly.
Et cetera, et cetera. A little hint, by the way, that there he was speaking telepathically to him as well, perhaps. And then moments later, we'd get the actual reveal that it's Armand. I understand why they don't have him say Armand there, because you want to wait
for the very last
moment.
Because we're not wasting that yet.
If it was me, I would have left out the name altogether, because I don't believe when they're in their bedroom that Louis calling him Rashid.
Rashid, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is one of those moments where they are presumably alone and Daniel is passed out. So it does seem weird that you would use the alias there, unless it's just, you know, making sure you're keeping up the front.
I'll say this too. The scene that we get, the glimpse that we get of young Daniel and Armand, young Daniel and Louis in the season 2 trailer, I like the cinematography and everything in those scenes better than what we get here. This is the one part of season 1 I felt, especially now that I've rewatched it several times, this scene looks a little cheap. I don't know if it's like, if there's a glaze that they're putting over it to sort of like give it that shimmer. I don't know if it's just the bar. I don't know if it's the costuming. I like their outfits.
Yeah, something I'm about snatched this up scene, by it though, for some reason. I'm
something
like,
about this scene feels cheap to me.
Maybe that's on purpose. Maybe it's because it's a cheap place and it's cheap.
Or it's like hazy, right? It's like the fog of drugs.
The fog of memory.
Yeah. I don't know. But what a great reveal, though, to set up our season finale. And, you know, we know going into the season finale that we've now got this. He knows, but they don't know that he knows.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah. Moment. They don't know that we know that they know.
It's a really delicious moment. I'm excited about it.
I'm very much
looking forward to seeing the finale again with all of this context that we brought to it,
yes,
talking about it this time.
This show has so many layers and so many different directions. And it is, if you're really, like, you could watch this and just be like a casual viewer and think it's a great show. Not unlike our spouses probably do.
Yeah, right.
But
oh, yeah, that's very nice.
Yeah, that's, I mean, this show looks great. Everybody's hot. Yeah, the costumes are beautiful. I like the story. But then if you're a lunatic like we are, there's just so many different layers and directions you can dive into, speculation and hoping and dreaming and thinking. And yeah, we're so lucky. We're such lucky people.
I've looked at our stats. There's plenty of weirdos like us that are obsessing over this too.
I sniff around on Reddit. I know you weirdos are out there.
I want to talk a little bit here at the wrap up of this episode about Lestat's musicality and the fact that they included that in the show itself. Now, in the books,
yes,
Lestat does not compose a love song for Louis. And I don't think that we even hear specifically about a composition from Lestat to Nicholas either. Nicholas composes a song that is a part of the Vampire Lestat novel. But I love this edition, and obviously it's
too
a tease toward the Vampire Lestat novel itself and the rock star storyline. But the idea that Lestat is not only a musician, but a perfectionist. You know, Louis says here when they're talking about the recording of Come to Me, that he contracted the recording studio, and then when the musicians were unsatisfactory, he recorded every part himself.
Yes,
and
you also see that
hard in the 40s. I would assume.
I mean, my God,
multi-tracking wasn't really a thing, was it?
No, I don't know. Like, that would seriously require a lot of splicing. Also, we see it back with his moment in the opera with the tenor, the disappointing tenor. So I do too. I love that. That nod, that addition to his character.
So what do you think, like, what was he thinking having Antoinette sing on the song?
Oh, he was being an asshole, Joel. What do you mean, Joel? He was being an asshole. He knew exactly what that was going to do, and that's the moment when our boy swam across the fucking Mississippi River. What do you mean, what was he thinking? He was thinking, I'm about to get mine. I'm about to fix this. in the fucked up way possible.
It worked. I love Louis. It's such an ironic line there. He's holding the record and he goes, "You think a song gonna get to me?" And you're like, "Well,
and he's so angry.
You swam the Mississippi River to come see me, didn't you? You hadn't seen me in months."
That's a real fucking gross part of the Mississippi River, by the way. Just it's in case you don't know, it's the nastiest shit. It's the end.
It's the whole thing's a great scene, and I love, but the music itself is fantastic too, right?
Okay,
the song
company
is amazing.
It is, and in the music in this episode, I meant to say this right off the top, because the music in like the beginning of the episode is kind of like upbeat and like kind of this like calm sort of like happy, gentle instrumental music in what you're seeing, in what you're seeing does not match what you're hearing, and that's why it's such a brilliant choice to have this like this music that is so in contrast to the relationships and what you're hearing the characters say. It's such a huge contrast. I love it so hard at the beginning of this episode.
Well, so some of that orchestration really reminded me, too, of the scene from the first episode with Paul and Louis on the roof. The music in that scene.
Oh, really?
Is very innocuous, and it's very light-hearted and sort of nostalgic.
It is, 'cause, yes.
And then it turns when he jumps off, right? Like, there's a hard build moment that it's building to. And here, too, on the surface, we see a reconciliation, we see a family reuniting, and yet we know the underlying elements haven't changed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So nobody went to therapy in the interim. You can clearly tell there was no self-exploration in the time apart.
They'll swim the whole damn Mississippi instead of going to therapy.
What? Toxic masculinity again. Bless us.
Let's call out here, since we were talking about the music specifically, Daniel Hart, just an amazing composer here. The work that he did on this first season, again,
really
lots of things should have been award winning. This is one of those that really should have stood out, and I can't believe that no one acknowledged it in that way.
I know you and I are always going to notice music because we have musical backgrounds,
musical theater
like
background.
That. Yeah, absolutely, and we love music. We're always going to pick that out if it's good, bad, or ugly. And this is such a good example of and I hope that next season feels the same musically.
Yeah, I want it
to
grow.
You know, I expect it to be different, but I hope it has the same, like...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I want Armand's themes. I want...
Yeah!
You know, what does Paris feel like? It's got to feel different than New Orleans.
It has to. It is different.
Are we going to get Eastern European influences in the music, especially in the first part of the season, you know? Anyway, I'm excited about all of that, and I do think we've got the right team in place to bring us those, you know, shades and interesting aspects. Man, what a great television series, right?
It's fantastic. This is so great. And we're so close to the new episodes. Meanwhile, we'll have an eclipse to enjoy, a solar eclipse, and... Oh, what a magnificent world we live in, even though it's a horrible, fiery dumpster fire of shit and misery sometimes. We can really, really kick back and enjoy sexy vampires.
It really does. It really does make it all easier to stomach, I promise. Thank you all for joining us for this rewatch. We got one more episode to go.
I have a really quick recommendation.
Please.
Just a real quick recommendation. This weekend, I finally watched, for the not-so-sexy vampires, The Last Voyage of the Demeter.
Oh, Dracula on a Boat.
Yeah. It's fantastic. A great romp. If you like a horror film, get on that. I think
I watched it. Is it streaming somewhere right now?
Yeah. I think I watched it on Prime.
Nice.
I think that's where I watched it.
All right.
It might have been attached to like my Paramount Plus or something. I'm not really sure. But, I wanted to recommend that for the people that have got their like Nosferatu side as well. This is not a pretty vampire.
Well, I do like to be reminded of the violence and the you know, visceral nature of vampirism occasionally.
Absolutely.
Both things are there, and both things are interesting, you know. I've heard good things about that movie as well, so I'm glad that you recommended that.
It's a wild ride. It's wild.
Awesome.
Very fun.
I would be very interested to see if they I don't think it did very well at the box office, but I would be very interested to see if they follow that up and make another chapter of the story. The Dracula, talking about adaptation versus translation, the Dracula novel, the original Dracula novel, is epistolary. It's all written in letters, and it is very fascinating, but it is also very limited in the points of view that you see of any particular aspect of the story. So it is rife, I think, for adaptation and broadening and deepening.
They definitely left that film open for a sequel.
For some follow-ups. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
That's very, very cool. Yeah, absolutely. Go check out some violent vampires, because these guys never do anything violent. So
no. Really, these different. Are sweet, sweet gentlemen. They never spill blood.
Lestat's going to eat a baby next week. Spoiler alert. Not a real baby, but, like a king cake baby. It's fine.
Oh, it's fine. It's
Mardi
Gras.
Guys. Don't worry
it's
about
Mardi
it. Gras. So, Ashley, we are doing this all wrong on the religious calendar. Here, as we get to Easter weekend, we're about to celebrate Mardi Gras.
We're backwards. We're bass backwards.
Yeah, but that's all right, folks. Join us next week, though. We're wrapping up season one. There is more coming as we await season two of Interview with the Vampire. So don't worry. We'll tell you more about that next week.
Absolutely.
And until then, go and see the finale and come back and join us for our rewatch. Until we come back again, we have been your hosts. I'm Joel.
I'm Ashley.
And we are the Articulate Coven. Thanks for listening to The Articulate Coven. You can join our community on Facebook by following the links in the show notes or searching for Articulate Coven on Facebook. You can subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or at articulatecoven.com. And share us with your Anne Rice-loving friends.